This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Wales heartbreak, England tedium, but we'll start with Everton deducted 10 points for breaching the rules. A fair punishment, or the Premier League trying to look tough as the regulator looms on the horizon? Everton aren't happy. There were mitigating circumstances and they were compliant. What does that mean for other clubs currently in the dock, or at least near the dock? On the pitch, Ellis James has sent us a mini podcast after Rob Page's men didn't turn up in Armenia. Then if you've just about managed to forget every last second of England 2 Malta 0, we'll remind you about it. France score 14, brackets 14. Scotland draw in an entertaining game that didn't matter too much, and Kai Havertz plays left back. All that, plus a new Football Weekly baby, your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Paul Watson, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, Max.
And from the Racing Post, Mark Langdon, hello.
Hi, Max.
Kim says, instead of a 10-point deduction, should Everton have been forced to re-sign Neil Mopay? Or would that punishment have been too severe? More sensible questions. Greg says, why was a 10-point punishment and not a fine or a transfer ban enforced, as first-time offenders for Everton seemed excessive for what they've done? Richard says, why are so many journos saying Everton's penalty's harsh when they could easily have avoided FFP by just selling Michael Keane rather than offering him a new contract? Isn't FFP just cheating when the impact is obvious? If they'd sold Keane, for example, they may have gone down in 21-22. So Everton deducted 10 points for breaching the Premier League's profit and sustainability rules, PSR, which is the Premier League's version of FFP. This leaves them in the relegation zone on 4 points. They were charged and found guilty of one count of breaking the rules, just to compare. We'll get onto that. So the rules require teams not to lose more than 105 million over 3 years, with non-football costs excluded from the calculation. The commission found Everton overreached their allowed losses by 19.5 million and concluded this was a serious breach that requires a significant penalty. Everton released a statement saying they're both shocked and disappointed by the ruling of the Premier League's commission. They will appeal. Thoughts, Barry?
Well, I think the Premier League were pushing for a 12-point deduction. Everton got a 10-point deduction, and there seems to be a school of thought that suggests this will go down on appeal. It won't be quashed, but it may go down to 6. I don't think it's unnecessarily harsh. I think a lot of Everton fans seem to think they're being picked on, but the fact of the matter is they did break the rules. A lot of it is down to interest payments they were paying for their new stadium on the docks there in Merseyside, and they, by all accounts, cooperated fully with the investigation, but were found to have experts in who were making the figures look less bad than they actually were. And they've cited extenuating circumstances in that the Russian invasion of Ukraine affected them, because Russian company USM had exclusive naming rights for this as yet unbuilt stadium worth £200 million. And that, because of the sanctions imposed on Russia, that evaporated overnight. They cited the COVID pandemic as an extenuating circumstance, but I'm not sure that washes, because everyone was affected by the COVID pandemic, all football clubs. And then there was the case of a player who, through no fault of the club's own, couldn't play for a season and had no sell-on value, and they had to let his contract run down before he was let go. So the punishment, it's harsh, and it may be the Premier League setting a precedent, but this was reached, as the Premier League have made abundantly clear, by an independent tribunal. And yeah, everyone's now waiting to see what will happen to other clubs whose finances are being inspected.
In pure footballing terms, Paul, feels like quite a good season for a points deduction.
There's never a good time for a points deduction.
No,
if there was, I don't know. It feels very Everton, doesn't it? They finally pull themselves, you know, up to mid-table, get themselves out of trouble, and then they're pushed straight back down. But yeah, I think they'll be fine. I think they'll stay up. I think there's more than enough rubbish at the bottom there to keep them afloat. So in a way, take the hit now, get the punishment paid and move on. But it has a slight feeling of, you know, when the police get a mafia boss, but he's obviously a middle, like a kind of nobody. They take down someone and they parade him. But there's this unspoken that there's like much bigger fish that they've not got. So it's a bit like that, isn't it? It's like, great, you got Everton, but we all know there's more business to do.
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine Sean Dyche getting a real, you know, I was chatting to Sam Avery, the comedian and an Everton fan on the radio the other day, and he was like, God, I want the next game to be like now, because the atmosphere will be febrile. It'll be quite amazing, Goodison. I think they've got Man United at home in their next game. I think it's Super Sunday, and it'll be like, it will be rocking that, you know, I mean, until obviously Everton concede after 10 minutes and then they'll all start booing again. But like, that will be quite amazing. Do you think, Mark, there's any strength Everton fans saying, look, you know, six clubs tried to leave this league a couple of years ago and they didn't get any punishment. Like, is there any merit in that argument or not really?
I mean, it's quite a different kind of case or cases in that regard. And, you know, I don't think we quite knew kind of what that actually meant. They might actually have stayed in the league but played a reserve team or youth team or whatever in Premier League, which, I think the Super League sort of breakaway six could have been sort of punished harsher. But, we often say, like, what about tree, don't we, on this pod? And I think if you just look at the Everton case in isolation, I think it's very difficult to know where the right point penalty is. I do think that, like, fines don't actually wash. And if you kind of, we're looking at it from Everton's point of view here, but if you were to change it around and look at one of those teams that went down instead of Everton, maybe they, you know, because they stayed in the rules, they didn't have one player that could have made the difference for them. And look, I think it's really harsh on Everton supporters because, and we've said this before about other owners, you very rarely you get the opportunity to kind of, you know, pick your owners, and they very much picked the club. And actually, it was their fans that were raising the point of how bad the owners were probably long before anybody else was. And now they're arguing sort of a different case. So I do feel sorry for the supporters, but I don't think that this is completely kind of, the first time. I mean, you only got to look at the EFL to see, you know, there are a lot of teams that have suffered point deductions that have taken them, you know, down the leagues, and their clubs are in crisis. There are other leagues in Europe where teams have had point deductions for various things. We've seen teams kicked out of Europe for not meeting UEFA sort of financial fair play. So I don't think this is completely on its own, albeit it's the first time, in terms of Premier League. I remember, as a Spurs fan, I remember when they got the 12-point deduction and kicked out of the FA Cup back in the mid-90s. It was absolutely devastating, more at the FA Cup than the points at the time. It shows kind of how feelings towards that competition have maybe changed. But I was very angry. I think it was the Premier League or the FA at the time. So I do get Everton's anger, but just looking at it, without any passion towards it, some of the arguments seemed flimsy, I think, from Everton's point of view.
I suppose one thing Everton fans could point to with some justification is the fact that Portsmouth went into administration years ago and they only got a 9-point deduction, you know, and them going into administration affected a lot of people, obviously. You know, loads of people lost their jobs at the club and whatnot. So, yeah, I reckon this appeal, it won't be overturned, I'd imagine, but it may, the number of points may be reduced.
There's going to be an impact on the takeover. There are built-in clauses relating to the purchase of a club. It means the price of the sale will drop if the charges are upheld, which they have been, the takeover by 777 Partners. That's a different podcast or a different Josimara article if you want to learn about 777.
I think if the takeover by 777 might be affected, that could be a good benefit for Everton.
Possible, yes. And of course, those three relegated clubs are looking into trying to get compensation as well, aren't they, from Everton? Feels like a lot. At some point, I guess you have to let things go, don't you? That's sort of how I feel. I think, I don't know. I'm not one of those clubs who were relegated, right? Another bit of Everton's statement said, the club will also monitor with great interest the decision made in any other cases concerning the Premier League's profit and sustainability rules. Fraser said, should Lord Panic be starting to panic now? I can see, imagine him sat in a hyperbaric chamber in a dark room in his mansion, ready to leap into action any day. Cometh the hour, cometh the panic. Yes, Paul, Man City have been charged with more than 100 alleged breaches of the rules. Are yet to have a verdict amid legal wrangling on both sides. City have denied wrongdoing. Chelsea are under investigation for alleged breaches relating to the era of Roman Abramovich's ownership. There's lots of idle speculation, Paul. Are these the same? Are they different? Do you know?
I'll be honest, I don't know. I'm totally neutral. I've made it very clear. I'm a Bristol City fan. I have no problem with Man City. Personally, I don't have a bias in this. But I do think, as a neutral, I would love to see them relegated to step 22, as I think is basically what clearly has to happen. But mostly just so I can coach them. That's my ambition. Bring them back. In fact, it'd be the ultimate sort of football manager save, wouldn't it? Yeah. Bring back Man City from step 22 all the way back up to glory. So
if of course they are found guilty of any of these charges, yes.
And in fact, I'm listening out in case there are lawyers at my door already. So saying that, yeah.
I mean, actually, Mark, are there direct comparisons to be made with these cases or not?
I think until we've seen sort of the full evidence and report, it's difficult to know, isn't it? Really, I think a lot of cities, I think, is slightly different. There's 115 charges to go through. So you know, there's been a push in more recent times to speed up the process, and that was something that the Premier League teams all agreed to, including Everton. So yeah, I mean, if City are found guilty, then they should have the book thrown at them. And as has been pointed out previously, you know, if they were to be relegated, for instance, the EFL, there's no obligation for them to take them into their league. So as Paul's saying, you know, it might be relegation might mean sort of National League or below, but I think it's difficult to compare the two until we've sort of seen all of the evidence, which we haven't seen in terms of, you know, in City's case. So I certainly haven't gone through the 115. I don't know if you have, Max.
Well, I think City are being charged. Some of the offences they're being charged with relate to outright deceit and dishonesty, which makes it different to the Everton case. And they've also been charged with obfuscation, non-cooperation with the investigation, whatnot. So if they are found guilty, one suspects their punishment would be a lot greater, a lot more severe than a 10-point deduction.
We shall see, probably in about 25 years' time.
Yeah.
That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll go on the pitch, if that's okay with everyone. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Look, we're midway through the tour. Dublin tonight, tomorrow, Brighton on Wednesday. No tickets available, but the live stream. We'd love you to come anywhere on earth. You know, Paul and Mark were both in Bristol. I'm sure they can vouch for that. It will be. I mean, they didn't pay, but it's money well spent. But like, to be clear, they didn't. You know, they didn't pay to do the show. That seems harsh. So look, come. On Wednesday, and it's available on Catch Up as well. So go to theguardian.com/FWTour23, musical numbers, Barry's holiday slideshow, amongst other things that you will see if you do that. James says, does time seem to slow down during an international break, or is it just me? I was thinking about this the other day. So just about getting fit. You can't just be fit. That's the tournament, is being fit. You actually have to run and do exercise, and that's what international breaks are. Let's start with Wales's draw in Armenia. Reece says, is Ellis okay? It's been a shit few days. I'm still deluding myself into thinking we'll qualify on Tuesday. Croatia must be tired by now. Ellis has sent us basically a podcast, and here it is.
Sunday night. It's about 25 to 1 in the morning. I've just had three bowls of crunchy nut cornflakes and a bottle of Staropram, and Max, I'm at a low ebb. That was a negative. And right now, I need two positives, Max. We're Armenia 1, Wales 1. To fill the listeners in, especially the non-Welsh listeners, had we beaten Armenia on Saturday afternoon, that would have left it open then for us to qualify outright by beating Turkey on Tuesday night. It is out of our hands now. We need Armenia to take points off Croatia away. That game is in Croatia. And for us to beat Turkey in Cardiff to qualify automatically. If that doesn't happen, which I think is pretty unlikely, it's the playoffs for us. The playoffs fill me with dread because obviously we've lost our, you know, generational once-in-a-lifetime match winner in Gareth Bale. Let's talk about the game. It ended 1-1. Armenia could still qualify automatically if they'd won. So they were in a similar position to us, which meant there was like a sort of basketball match. They scored after 5 minutes, which meant that our game plan was thrown out the window. In defence of Rob Page, and Rob Page obviously divides opinion, and yes, of course, the World Cup was a shambles, and yes, of course, there have been times, I think, when he's been tactically naive, but we were genuinely brilliant against Croatia in Cardiff in October, and I suppose whether you think that he worked out a first 11 that seemed to work or stumbled upon it, I suppose, is how charitable you feel towards Rob Page. I just think that the game in October against Croatia in Cardiff, he just had found a balance and a formation, sort of gone back to five at the back, which is how we've traditionally played for years, with young Jordan James, what a player he is, and Ethan Ampadu, who I could talk about forever because I think Ethan is a great player, in a sort of double pivot, and then you've got Brooks and Moore and Harry Wilson up front because Aaron Ramsey was injured for that fixture, just like he was injured for us on Saturday. We really missed him, incidentally. I said it was like a basketball match. His experience and cool head, I think, would have really sorted us out if he'd been playing. But never mind. You can't change that. In fairness to Rob Page, he selected the same 11. He started the same 11, which is what 99% of our supporters would have liked him to have done. And there's some big calls there. Like, he left out Brennan Johnson. He left out Dan James. Brennan Johnson in particular, you know, you would think, well, you've got to find room for him. But he didn't. So Brennan was a sub. He came on. He didn't do a huge amount. In defence of Rob Page, most of our players, well, a significant amount of our players aren't playing regularly at a club level. And that really, really showed. Kiefer Moore is a good example. I think he's had 14 minutes since that Croatia game for his club. And there was sloppiness all round. But Page is kind of damned if he doesn't, because if he selects, I don't know, Nathan Broadhead, for instance, who is playing regularly for his club, ahead of one of the players who did so well against Croatia in October, and that doesn't come off, then obviously he would get criticised for that. So I think he was in quite a difficult position. But either way, the Armenia have got a player called Zelarayan, who is now in the Saudi League. We make him look like Stoichkov and Haji rolled into one. We were unable to cope with him in June. We were unable to cope with him on Saturday. I think Armenia are, to us, a bit like what we were to Belgium for years and years. They have just got our number and we cannot beat them. It is, however, a really, really daft group. So if you look at the fixtures, or if you look at the results, you know, Turkey drew with Armenia at home. Turkey qualified for the Euros with a game to spare. You know, Latvia beat Armenia. We beat Croatia. It's been tight and it's been silly and everyone's taken points off each other. You know, should we win against Turkey and Armenia, take points off Croatia. We were qualified via the head-to-head because we drew with Croatia out there and then beat them in Cardiff, which, you know, I don't think anyone saw coming. So, yeah, we need to... I just went for a bike ride to unwind because this result has really upset me. I'm going to turn up on Tuesday and I'm going to have a few pints with my mates, so I always go with, and we have to go for it as if we can qualify. So we've got to try and win the game and then hope that it's lucky for us elsewhere. That's the only mind frame or mindset you can have going into this match. And that's fine, you know, that's fine. We've been in sticky situations in this. One thing I will say, though, is that there were news reports over the weekend because 32 Welsh fans got nicked out in Armenia. I know a few of them, and they are the least likely hooligans you will ever meet in your life. Proper latte-sipping Guardianistas. And they were just walking back to the hotel. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were just walking back to the hotel. They got bundled into a van. They weren't told why they were being arrested. They weren't charged with anything. They were held overnight. They weren't given food to eat or water to drink. They were treated really badly and then just released without charge as if nothing had happened. So I don't want anyone to be misled by those headlines because I do a lot of Wales Away and we like a drink. And we're noisy, but we're not dicks. And I think that the people who got nicked were just in the wrong place in the wrong time. And I, you know, I don't know all 32, but I know quite a few. And they are the least likely hooligans you can imagine. So that was a real shame. And but anyway, we move on. We move on to Tuesday. Fingers crossed we can get a win in Cardiff. There seems to be such disparity between our performances at home and away. Thankfully, we are at home against Turkey, you know, which makes me slightly more confident. Not that I'm very confident, but who knows? Football is a daft game. I don't know what first 11 he's going to play. Obviously, he'll have to bring in Lockyer, you'd imagine, for Chris Mepham, because Chris Mepham is suspended because he got booked on Saturday. Oh, God.
Thank you, Ellis. That was quite long. So I'm going to move on to England, if that's all right. I hope you didn't have any majorly hot takes on that Wales-Armenia game because Ellis has done it all for us. Matt says, is Barry less concerned about the Euros having seen that England performance? Yes, England 2, Malta 0. Oh, that was a hard watch, Baz.
Yeah, it was a pretty grim game with nothing really riding on it. And yet, there were, you know, capacity Wembley crowd at it, which just shows how popular the England team are at the moment. I think England have an excellent chance of winning the Euros. I think the one thing, I'm not a Gareth Southgate fan. I think I've made that clear. I see Jonathan Wilson wrote that article yesterday in which he more or less decried Southgate's skeptics as morons, and that's fine.
He could have just sent it to you, couldn't he? He didn't need to write in a paper.
That's fine, but he kind of made my argument for me in his piece. I am aware, as he says, that Southgate is the most successful England manager since Alf Ramsey. I'm aware that he got England to a final and a semi-final, but my problem with him is the manner in which he lost that semi-final and that final. When England were on top in both games, should have won and didn't. That is my problem with Gareth Southgate. He's too cautious at those times. His in-game management is, I think, incredibly suspect. So that is my problem with Southgate, and I think that could, you know, be a problem again. But I would give England every chance of winning the Euros. The only team I can see in Europe that is better than them is probably France. But the best teams don't always win tournaments.
I feel like I've heard you say those
so many times.
I understand if people forward wound through
absolutely.
Those 2 minutes, Mark.
Well, Jonathan Wilson sort of had the same thing with various managers, isn't he?
Yeah, so,
it's not just Barry.
There was lots of frothing at the mouth, Mark, at this game. Does it matter? Or is that just because it's the only game in town, right? So we're all watching it and all we've got to fill air time talking about it.
It doesn't matter. Obviously, you know, if you spend your money to go to that game, you're presumably you're hoping, you know, to see the stars, and you know, you might maybe don't always get to watch them at kind of Premier League level, and this was an opportunity to do that. But it's a completely different game. There's no jeopardy on it. You know, they probably, the England players probably woke up knowing that they were going to win the game. It was a case of how many they were going to win by. That, I don't think, you know, if you're an elite sports person, that's probably not a great way to enter sort of, you know, a match day. They went through the motions. They'd scored after 7 or 8 minutes. So it was just the case of just waiting for the next goal to come. There were no injuries, and, you know, it'd be a boring thing to kind of go on about. But, you know, if you're an England player, surely you are thinking about Premier League or Bundesliga or La Liga, in, you know, whatever league you're playing in. Champions League's coming back. On this international break, Vinicius ruled out 2.5 months playing for Brazil. Gavi did his ACL last night, out for several months. You know, the kind of demands on players have never been greater. The rewards have never been higher. But just because you're rich doesn't mean that you can avoid these injuries. So I think being sensible and, you know, just thinking about the rest of the season, it's a long season coming up. So do you really need to be charging around against Malta when you've already qualified? Of course you don't. You know, I understand completely why Gareth Southgate had a look at Tomori at left back rather than, say, bring in a younger player and stuck him there, because in a sort of tournament situation, maybe, you know, Tomori's in the squad and, you know, you're not going to take sort of 4 or 5 left backs. So if the 2 left backs get injured, there's something, you know, Trippier gets suspended or whatever, you need to just be able to see if somebody else can do a job there. And it was just a time to see a couple of different things. Dion Dublin made me laugh in commentary when Harry Maguire played a pass out of the back that was intercepted, and he was saying, "You've got to show more respect to Malta. You know, you can't just play those risky passes." And later on in the half, he's clearly completely frustrated with what England has served up and said, "You know, no disrespect to Malta, but we've got to be beating these by more." Which one is it, Dion? You know, are we showing them respect or are we not? But look, this happens sort of during England's qualifying campaigns. And I think overall, you know, the qualifying was done when England won in Italy. You know, it was on the first match day. And since then, you know, it's been a stroll for them. And the fact that we've got so many teams going to the Euros means there isn't much jeopardy in many of these games. I know Ellis is feeling it at the moment. But, this was done ages ago. So I think there are legitimate reasons to stick the boot into Gareth Southgate going back to, say, the Euros final against Italy. But I can't get overworked up by, you know, just beating Malta 2-0.
Paul, Harry Kane was booked for diving. I mean, it seems harsh. He's not that kind of player, is he?
No, I couldn't believe it either. I mean, that is a little bit embarrassing, isn't it, against Malta? I think the thing that I wanted to flag up about Malta is I think people do have a slightly unrealistic expectation of how bad Malta are. So there's obviously a spectrum of teams across Europe, and Malta are very much in the lower end, but they're not a team you beat 8-0, 9-0. You know, they're a team, the general sort of possibility is you can beat them 2-0, you can beat them 4-0. If you have a really good day, you might beat them 5-0. But I think realistically, 2-0 was fine. And I think people are still looking at them as if, you know, this is a pretty organised team. Italian boss, Marcolini's got them set up pretty well. Like, 2-0 was pretty much the lower end of expectation. But honestly, you know, if you don't want to watch these games, then by all means, don't watch them. But they're not going to be goal fests, not this one.
Mm. I mean, Harry Kane probably was fouled. I thought it was strange that VAR overturned it, but perhaps, you know, he's probably got away with the odd dive in his career. I think it's fair to say. England are in North Macedonia tonight. Thank God we're on stage in Dublin and we don't have to watch it. We found something else to do. Kieran says, if this is the end of Stephen Kenny's reign as Republic of Ireland manager as expected, how would Baz sum it up? And who would be his ideal successor? They lost 1-0 in the Netherlands. Wout Weghorst with the goal.
And it was Wout Weghorst running onto a through ball and finishing, spanking the ball into the top corner near post. Not the a goal you see Wout Weghorst score very often. I expect this is the end of the Stephen Kenny regime, and it's been an absolute disaster. Ireland, well, you know, they were in a really tough group. France, Netherlands, Greece, they lost all six games they played against them. Stephen Kenny keeps saying they're really close and these games are decided by, you know, little margins. But, you know, if you're losing six games against the teams you're trying to qualify against, that's just not good enough. He has brought through a lot of young players. That's the only thing, but they're not playing particularly well. And I'd be astonished if his contract is renewed, and I have no idea who they will get in next. Lee Carsley is one name that's been bandied about. He's manager of England under 21s, so if he gets the job, it'll be interesting to see how he gets on. But
don't want Big Mick or Roy Keane or Mick and Roy together?
I know Martin O'Neill, I think, is quite bitter about the manner in which his time in charge. So maybe he deserves another chance. But yeah, it's really disappointing. I wasn't expecting to qualify, but I thought we'd go out with not a bang, but certainly not a whimper like we have done.
There was this loophole, which meant the Republic of Ireland needed to lose to the Netherlands. But sadly, even that is no good anymore, as they've fallen behind Bosnia and Herzegovina, Finland, Georgia, Greece, Israel, Luxembourg and Poland, who are confirmed in playoff spots, and Croatia, Italy, Kazakhstan and Ukraine, who are assured at least a playoff spot via their Nations League ranking. The Netherlands only need a point from their final game in this group against Gibraltar, which, I mean, maybe Gibraltar will bounce back. You know, sometimes the worst time to play a team is after, after a bad defeat. Alan says, is scoring 14 goals in a game rude? To be honest, I started to get offended after 11, and I'm not from Gibraltar. And Kapanosti says, isn't it fun to see a minnow get a proper old school shellacking? Yes, France was 7-0 up at halftime, and 7-0 at halftime is never 14-0 at full time. So hats off to France. I say, where do you stand, Paul, as the minnow representative?
I've got to admit, I did quite enjoy it. I feel quite sorry for Gibraltar. This is where it sounds a bit funny to say it, but Gibraltar are just not picking a lot of their best players. So it's actually, the coach has got to go. I think there's a lot of pressure on Julio Ribas there. The FA generally is not running things well. So while Gibraltar would have got pretty badly beaten, I think, by any France team, I think going down to 10 men early on and having a pretty weak Gibraltar team out there, it was just not even fair.
Why is he not picking his best player? I mean, it seems silly.
Politics. He's picking a lot of the older guard. He's clinging on to a lot of players that are basically past their best. And there are some really talented young Gibraltarian players out there. So yeah, I hope they'll get themselves together. But yeah, I think that 7-0 team talk, when you're going in at half time, 7-0 down to France, I think my team talk would be the sound of me starting the bus up, I think.
Yeah.
When you think a forfeit is only 3-0, isn't it? So yeah.
Mbappe, his third goal was lovely for his hat-trick. A delightful chip over presumably quite a disconsolate Gibraltar, be my feelings about this. 300 career goals from Mbappe. Olivier Giroud got a couple. Warren Zaïre-Emery is 20 years younger than Giroud. He actually got injured, didn't he? Which is a shame, but because he became the youngest player to debut for France in over 100 years at 17 years, 8 months and 10 days. So well done to him. Scotland drew 2-2 in Georgia on Thursday night, followed up with a 3-3 draw at home to Norway. They equalised twice, took the leads with Stuart Armstrong goal. Mohamed El Yunusi equalised late on for Norway, who don't qualify. So no Ødegaard, no Haaland at the Euros. I mean, it mattered a tiny bit, Mark, didn't it, in terms of what pot they go into. But, you know, they still got T-shirts and saying we're off to Germany. And it's been a brilliant campaign for them.
Yeah, so that was probably the only, disappointing aspect of the campaign. They could have finished in pot two, but not to be. So pot three for Scotland, but it's been a fantastic sort of group stage for them. We were speaking earlier there about Ireland, and you know they had a tough draw. I don't think this was a particularly pleasant one for Scotland. Georgia, probably a dangerous side, sort of in terms of kind of below sort of Scotland in the seedings. Norway, as you mentioned, there have got some top players. Maybe not put it all together, and then Spain, one of the best teams in Europe. So for Scotland to have done it so well in such style as well is testament to the work that Steve Clarke has done. In these games, obviously, it didn't matter. And so I think they did sort of relax somewhat. And, you know, that may be played out in terms of the final scores. But, you know, a lot of jokes about sort of Scotland not being able to qualify in terms of once they get to a major final. So I think, you know, obviously draw depending, but they've got a really good chance, I think, of making the knockout stages when you look at kind of those pot two teams around Europe. And yeah, good luck to them. I think that Steve Clarke has done what Stephen Kenny's been unable to do. Now, he has got better players for sure, but there is a spirit there that kind of I think is what you need at international level. You need to you know, be able to get your best players to want to turn up regularly. You know, that feels like half the battle. And you look at somebody like John McGinn now, who is turning in sort of excellent performances, Premier League and internationally. And yeah, I just really like the way that Scotland are playing football. Now, they've had their sort of downs, I suppose, in terms of the international friendlies. They were beaten by England, weren't they? And also France, which maybe shows their limitations. But just look at their squad list. Manager's good. Yeah, I'm sort of encouraged about sort of what they might be able to do in Germany. I don't think they're just turning up, you know, to have a drink, three games and go home. I think there's more to Scotland than that.
Dark horses, perhaps. All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll rattle through the rest of the Euro qualifying groups and do any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Group E, then Albania have qualified for just the second time in their history. They drew in Moldova on Friday. Czech Republic drew at Poland. So that means Poland miss out on automatic qualification. Albania, Paul, dark horses?
Well, yeah, it's actually a really interesting story around Albania. So their manager, Silvino, has done a brilliant job. There's this beautiful footage of him running the length of the sideline, like quite aggressively high-fiving fans. Like some of those high-fives, I thought, if they're not stopped, this is a broken nose. Like he's going mental. But quite amazing what Albania have done is I think they've got this this hero who's in the back room who no one really knows about, who went through databases and made a database for the first time of Albanian players, players that were like eligible for selection. And like really like dug deep into like player heritage. They never had a database like this. I think some of the players that are really like lighting up the qualification, helped them through, were players that he unearthed who actually could qualify to play for Albania, who just for whatever reason had not done so. So it's kind of a Moneyball style thing. You know, I think there's kind of an analyst in the background who's yeah, done this incredible job. But lovely to see him playing like that. It's brilliant.
Belgium beat Azerbaijan 5-0 yesterday. 4 goals in 20 minutes for Romelu Lukaku, 83 for his country. 7th on the list of top scorers for Belgium. Because they've had some big scorers. Who's up there? Enzo Schifo? I don't know. Oh, sorry. 7th on the list of top scorers in the world. Yeah, I was thinking that for a second. Okay, that changes things. So who are these Belgians just rattling them home? I haven't noticed. They're through with Austria, Hungary, and through with Serbia as well. Serbia, it's been a long time for them, hasn't it, for the Serbians? So nice to see them. I mean, Mark, Paul, or Barry, stop me if you have anything interesting to say about these.
Well,
guys.
Just Szoboszlai scored an absolute wonder goal for Hungary in there. Qualification then was seen drinking with the supporters after the game, doing a shot of something that sort of made him wince as he downed it. But he's been great for Liverpool so far, you know, fantastic for Hungary as well. And yeah, his individual goal, I mean, I think so often we sort of associate Szoboszlai with thunderbolts really, but this was individual goal, taking on players and finishing beautifully. So yeah, he's sort of playing himself in great nick for the rest of the year.
And I believe so Hungary got 12 game unbeaten run now, which I think's the longest in world football now that Argentina's is gone. And I think it starts from the moment they made him captain, doesn't it? I think he's every game that he's captain, Szoboszlai, they've won. Or not won, but they haven't lost. So that's a pretty impressive impact, I think.
Dark horses, Max.
Okay, they're dark horses, right? Denmark sealed their qualification. Big game tonight between Slovenia and Kazakhstan. Winner takes all. or draw for Slovenia takes all. What can the Kazakhs do, Paul?
I think it's a step too far for them, but it's been an incredible campaign. I think I mentioned before, like, they actually only came over from AFC to UEFA relatively recently, and no one gave them a hope in this campaign. In fact, before this campaign, talking to San Marino fans, they thought Kazakhstan was the game they could win out of all of them. Didn't turn out that way. Although they did score. San Marino did score twice in two games now.
Yes, twice in two games. That's huge, isn't it?
First time since 2005 they've scored in back-to-back games. But yeah, Kazakhstan, I think it's a step too far for them, but they'll play off, I think.
A hot streak for the San Marinoese. San Marinoese? Is that? How would I say?
San Marinese, I think. San Marinese, yeah.
San Marinese. Group I, group was settled on Saturday. Romania beat Israel 2-1. Switzerland drew 1-1 with Kosovo. They play each other tomorrow night to decide who wins the group. Portugal smashed Group J. They might even just be horses for the tournament behind England and France in the favourite, Slovakia through as well. Jim says, can Luxembourg go again? Or was this their best chance? So sad for Luxembourg, Paul. Every time you gave them hope, it was your fault.
There's a one moment that will haunt them forever, I think. And it's their player who, top scorer, national top scorer, Gerson Rodriguez, brilliant player, has a open goal miss against Iceland in the game that finished 1-1. And I think that basically will go back as the moment they lost it. Because they've been absolutely sensational in this campaign. And yeah, who would have thought we got to a point where Luxembourg were this close? But I think the playoffs will be tough for them now. And it's such a shame because I know growing up, if you'd said Luxembourg would qualify for Euro, I'd have thought you'd gone absolutely mental. But they have been sensational, except for losing 9-0 to Portugal. Except when they lost 9-0 to Portugal and their coach left at 8-0.
Oh, brilliant. Really good. Elsewhere, Jürgen Nagelsmann's first defeat as Germany manager, 3-2 to Turkey at home in a friendly. I mean, obviously lots of Turks live in Germany. It was like it was basically a home game for Turkey. And Kai Havertz playing left back, Barry. We finally, you know, it's like players just go, you know, you start as, we all start as a centre forward, go to centre mid, and then you end up back there kind of, maybe this is his calling.
Yeah, it seems to have prompted a lot of head scratching. I was certainly bemused when I heard about it, and it didn't work, obviously. So who knows? He might start the next one in goal when come the Euros. Could he do a job in goal? We don't know.
He'd be quite a relaxed goalkeeper. I'd quite like to. He did score, didn't he? I think after 5 minutes. So like initially it was like, wow, this is wonderful. But then, you know, Turkey did win, Mark.
Yeah, they did. I mean, Nagelsmann said afterwards that Havertz was one of Germany's best players, and that this is not just a one game experiment. He thinks he can do it. I would love to see him displace Manuel Neuer in goal. I'm sure Neuer would be really chilled out about that. He feels like that sort of character. Yeah, I mean, it's a time for experimentation for Germany. I know Lothar Matthäus, who is kind of the rent-a-quote in Germany. You know, if Harry Redknapp gets the call kind of every 2 minutes in England, it's always Lothar Matthäus. He wasn't happy with how sort of Havertz displaced Rahm, the usual left-back, and felt it was sort of disrespectful. But I think if you're Nagelsmann, you haven't got that many games now until the Euros, you need to try some things. But the problem for Germany is the same one that Bayern Munich have got, in that they just haven't got that defensive midfielder. So they're conceding too many goals. And Joshua Kimmich insists that he can play as that defensive midfielder. But the stats maybe suggest that he needs somebody alongside him that is more of, you know, a sitter, more of a Didier Deschamps style than what they've currently got. And yeah, until they sort out that defence, very difficult to see a team win a sort of international tournament being that bad defensively.
I mean, Lothar Matthäus could stop talking and start playing, couldn't he? There you go.
I suppose in the discussion about dark horses, the perennial dark horses that are Turkey, have to merit a mention in that dark horse category.
Yes, you've stolen. I've written our Turkey dark horses in.
Oh, so, you know, sorry.
Of course. No, don't apologise. You're absolutely right to bring it up. I mean, they did qualify well in Wales's group, didn't they, Mark?
They did, yeah. And, you know, obviously Croatia have had not a vintage campaign, and it might turn out to not have been the strongest of groups. But certainly I think Turkey are I don't want to big them up too much. I think I was one of those that fell for them in the last Euro. So I've tried to be calm about their chances. But I mean, ultimately, despite the fact that we've spent nearly an hour discussing them, the qualifying really doesn't matter. Once you get there, it's a completely different tournament. You play against teams of a different level to what you're playing in sort of these round-robin stage usually. And, you know, we've seen before Turkey not be good enough and not be able to handle that environment. So, you know, until they do that, I think it's difficult to put too much trust in them.
Outside of Europe, Australia are due to play Palestine tomorrow in a World Cup qualifier in Kuwait. They drew 0-0 with Lebanon on Thursday. The Socceroos will donate to humanitarian efforts in Gaza. The game was only moved last week to a new venue due to safety concerns. It was going to be played in Ramallah in the West Bank. The last time Palestine played at home was against Saudi Arabia in 2019. The pledge from the Socceroos was confirmed by The Guardian on Friday. Includes a match donation from Football Australia. It'll be provided to Oxfam through the PFA Footballers Trust. Horatio says, I'm writing to ask that you please speak about how Messi and De Paul both grabbed Napoli's Oliveira by the throat in the World Cup qualifier after De Paul instigated a fight with Uruguay. Messi threw an elbow at Oliveira. I'm admittedly biased as a Uruguayan, but have always been a Messi fan, but not one journalist has criticised this. If Suarez did it, he would have been banned for life by FIFA. Instead, they dismiss it because it's a different player. Ugarte gestured to De Paul that he was pleasuring Messi, I will say. De Paul also injured Maxi Araujo and was awarded a foul in his favour in a rugby-like tackle. The ref was visibly aggressive towards Uruguay from the start of the match. Disgrace that two players are allowed to choke a guy. Argentina showed how poor losers they really are. I mean, Uruguay won 2-0. I don't know if anyone is completely across what happened, Mark.
I mean, this is what you want. This is what everybody wants from South American qualifying. It's very difficult now, the way that the tournament's been extended, for teams not to qualify. It used to be the most competitive sort of section going. Now, so many spaces that it'd be difficult not to reach the next World Cup. So you want to see kind of proper South American action, I suppose. And this was definitely that. Beautifully described there what happened with the Ugarte. And I think that did, in some way, instigate what followed. So the good news for Uruguay is that Bielsa seems to be working his magic on that team, that can only be good, I think, for the World Cup with Uruguay there.
Nice to see Luis Diaz's father celebrating the stands when Luis Diaz scored in Colombia's 2-0 win over Brazil in the World Cup qualifier on Friday. There was news that Liverpool had flown Luis Diaz to the UK for Christmas. I was thinking, guys, it's only mid-November, guys. I mean, that is a long... You know, you want your parents there for Christmas, but, you know, let's get them there, you know, December. That just week lead up to Christmas seems the right time for that. You've mentioned Vinicius Junior's injury as well, so it's going to be out for about 10 weeks. Paul, you wanted to mention English managers in Asian World Cup qualifying matches.
Yeah, well, I wanted to give a special mention to Ashley Westwood, who has taken on possibly the most daunting job in the history of football. So he, you might remember Ashley Westwood. He was at Sheffield Wednesday for a while, and he played for almost everyone. He's become a very decent coach, coached in India. He took on the Afghanistan men's national job about 8 days before their game against Qatar. Flew into Kabul, handshakes. And I don't know whether he was aware that 19 of their senior players had gone on strike, led by the captain, against the federation. So 19 of their players are refusing to play because they believe the federation president is corrupt. So he's come into a team with no players 8 days before they played Qatar, and had to pick an entirely new domestic squad, pretty much. And it went about as well as you can imagine. They lost 8-1 to Qatar, and it could have been quite a few more. But I sort of thought he deserves a mention for taking that job on. Afghanistan national job with 8 days notice is that is, even by my standards, that's pretty crazy.
You've ruled yourself out, have you? You've ruled yourself out.
Yeah, Afghanistan. They called me first. Yeah. Also, I had to give a little mention to Stephen Constantine, who actually, his Pakistan side lost 4-0 to Saudi Arabia, but it's the first time they've ever actually got this far, Pakistan. And Constantine's done an amazing job coming in. He's actually, I think, the English manager who's coached the most national teams, but they're all crazy jobs. He's coached Nepal, he's coached Malawi, he's coached Sudan, you name it, he's coached these kind of weird national jobs. And he's actually come in and did a great job. They look very good actually against Saudi Arabia. They conceded two goals in the 90 plus minutes, but Pakistan really looking very good.
Luke says, check out this rabbit hole I fell down. I don't know, Paul, if you're aware of the Malaysian footballer called Dion Johan Chai Kools. Kools was born in Sarawak to a Belgian father, Hans Kools, and a Malaysian Chinese mother. They relocated to Belgium more than 20 years ago. He's named by his parents after Johan Cruyff and Dion Dublin. So this is great. Great to get one of the legendary players of the game and a target man. It's a sort of a really, that's a sort of a nice mix to have. So you could be named.
I thought you were going to say great to have a player named after one of the legendary figures of the game and Johan Cruyff.
Of course, that's what I should have said. You're absolutely right. Let's finish on this email from Ben, who says, on the theme of Football Weekly and medical procedures, I had tickets to your Manchester gig. I was shocked to be woken up on the morning by my wife, who'd gone into early labour. While I couldn't listen to the pod while my wife was giving birth, my mind couldn't help but wonder what the Will Unwin anecdote was, or what John Bruin would have made of our midwife putting on Heart FM when we asked for some music. My amazing wife Susie gave birth to our beautiful daughter Beatrice Anderson, who was born at 4:52 p.m. on the 15th of November, about 500 yards from the Royal Northern College of Music, and a stone's throw from Big Hands, where I hope Barry burns someone else's T-shirt. To make up for it, I was hoping for some classic Barry warm wishes. I mean, 10 to 5, he could have made it, couldn't he?
Yeah, easily. We didn't end up in Big Hands this time. We went, it was a nice pub called Salutation, where we hobnobbed with the front man and the bass player from the Cortiners, who were, well, I think Liam, the singer is and songwriter, is a big Football Weekly fan.
Yes, hello Liam. This is mainly for you to say congratulations.
Welcome to the world. Yes. Sorry.
Not you name dropping about the Cortinas.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I actually saw the Cortinas many, many years ago in at a London, I think University of London student union gig. So they have gone on to bigger and better things.
You're still not welcoming Beatrice. No.
This is about Beatrice. Welcome to the world.
Have a great time. That'll do for today's pod. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Thanks, Baz.
Thank you.
Cheers, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
We'll see you in Dublin tonight. Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.